Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West.
Both mother and son artists, Jean Quictessy Smith and Neil Ambrose Smith, are deeply connected to their heritage. Jean Quictessy creates work addressing the myths of her ancestor in the context of current issues facing American Indians, while Neil Ambrose Smith often mixes tribal imagery and humor with current events and political issues. Both are enrolled Salish, Cree, Shoshone, and Métis members from the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Nation in Montana, and we are delighted to have them as our guests today on Resounds. Welcome.
Thank you.
Jean, what made you want to be an artist, and when did that all begin?
It was really, really early. My father was a horse trader, and we were, I would say, pretty low income, and we were living in a cabin at Nisqually with two other families, and we'd have to roll up in our blankets against the walls so the adults didn't step on us when they came in at night. And there was really no furniture. There was a table and in there, but no beds because it was just a one-room cabin, outhouse out back, a pump out in the center for the cabins, a garbage pile at the back of the cabins where my sister and I scrounged for food during the daytime, sometimes trying to steal fish out of the smokehouses. And we had really no toys. I hadn't met up with crayons or anything like that at that point in time. So I mostly would draw, you know, in the mud or the dirt with sticks and make little chains out of the mosses, you know, mud pies, things like that. And I just knew that that was the thing that made me the happiest. You know, our world was pretty dank, pretty violent, and pretty scary. So then when I went to first grade, I discovered library paste and crayons. And of course, like all children, like all Indian children particularly, you smell it and you taste it. Somehow that's kind of our MO. And so I did that. Library paste was actually really good. Tempera paint, not so much. And crayons just got crumbly in my mouth. So that was my awakening. And I didn't know the word artist. I didn't know what art was. Just that if I finished my work, that's what I got to do. So pretty early on, I knew, you know, that I was destined for something like that. And it was a long, hard struggle. Having children at an early age and, you know, working jobs, trying to go to school, dropping out, going back. It took 20 years for me to get my graduate degree, and I just kept moving forward.
I love the image of drawing in the mud because your work has that raw sort of natural scratch, and it just fits beautifully. I love that metaphor. Thank you.
Thanks.
And Neil, let me ask, what was it like having a mother as an artist, and did she inspire you to get into art?
Well, sure. She's an inspiration. There's no doubt that her work feeds my work on multiple levels. And but she's, you know, she's just my mom. I wouldn't think about it any different than any other family. Like, the difference would be, I guess, when I went to a friend's house, the dishes would be clean and put away. And in our house, they were still in the sink because everybody was working and doing stuff. So, and, you know, while their mothers were in the kitchen, my mother was in the studio, that kind of thing. But I didn't see it as abnormal. I didn't really recognize or that kind of thing. I was just a kid. She's just my mom. Mm-hmm.
And when did you start getting into art?
Well, that, you know,
in his high chair. I would give him vanilla pudding and chocolate pudding
with a side of crayon.
Yeah, and the story goes that I would paint my face. And then I didn't eat it. I just wore it. And then my grandmother would come in and get all upset and yell at everybody, clean me up, and leave. And then my mom would get the chocolate pudding out again and slide it towards me. And so
I was teaching him to paint.
Yeah, you've done collaborative work from the very beginning.
We did. So we're still doing that.
I don't think artists, you know, like you can decide to go into business or something like that, but you don't decide to become an artist. It's not a conscious decision. It's, in many ways, it's like a disease, you know, it's just something you have, and it's a compulsion, and a nice way to put it would be like a passion. It's a passion. Mm-hmm. And so I think at some point you may look back and realize that all these things that you've been doing have been leading to in this direction, but it's there's not a moment where you decide, mm-hmm, I'm going to be an artist. I'm going to do this.
Who would do that? You'd have to be crazy.
You have to be crazy because it's the worst job.
You want to be the poorest of the poor?
You want everybody
to hate
you?
You want
to
not make any money?
And artists are worthless as a bane of society.
They're parasites.
Yeah.
They're no good for nothing.
They're
bums.
They're worse than a marginalized group.
Yeah. Who wants to be that?
Yeah. Oh, pick me.
I think it's funny because Anne and I are both like nodding. I went and got an MFA in sculpture and drawing, and Anna's a poet, which is another great career.
Yes,
exactly.
High-paying jobs. First, cultural anthropology, and then right into journalism.
Yeah, you
know, exactly.
Why pursue that? I might as well be a poet so that I can suffer through the rest of this life.
Right.
I was curious about what it's like to have such close familiar and artistic bonds, because your work does sometimes come together. You've done collaborative pieces such as at the Denver airport and other works together. Tell me a little bit about working together as artists.
You know, when you're working together as artists, it's not like mother and son. It's like at some point, you know, because of our interest in art, you know, we talk about books, we talk about artists, we talk about techniques, talk about art supplies. You know, if he calls me some morning when he's not busy, that's usually our discussion. It's not always about family matters, although that can enter into it. But it's not mother and son anymore, you know, it's peer-to-peer. And because I introduced him to non-toxic printmaking back in early 2000, and he began making prints, he's gone so far past me now technically into new media, new kinds of printmaking that I can't keep up with because he's mixed the computer with it. So he mixes the computer with the, you know, with the techniques of non-toxic ink and all the different media that you can mix with it. And he's so far beyond me technically that I can't keep up with him anymore. He teaches at the Indian Institute in Santa Fe, at the college in Santa Fe, and he's setting up their new printmaking department that's all non-toxic with all these new techniques. And this summer he's teaching at Making Art Safely in Santa Fe with a computer, and the plates come out of the computer. And I said to him, is this something that I could learn? Because I'm still taking classes. And he said, you probably wouldn't like it. Because I still am someone who wants to draw on the plate and not on the computer. And he can do both, which, you know, he's ambidextrous. And that to me, of course, that's exciting to me to see him. He draws much better than I do. And when I see, you know, his paint techniques and things that he can do that are beyond what I can do, that's really happiness for me. That makes me excited and thrilled.
It's a teaching workshop, so I didn't think it would benefit you. And right now, what's more important for me is that you make work, and not sit here and try to struggle with a new technique. Like I can facilitate things for you to help you make new work with using new techniques, but it's just not worth it.
And this is an example right here of us switching roles. When you hear him talk to me this way, he becomes my mentor and my teacher. So often when I've had to do a lot more writing lately, Princeton is doing a show on the environment and they asked me to write a piece for the catalog, which has not been my forte in the past. And you know, even though I have things to say, hasn't been my, you know, I wasn't trained for that. They're training people for that now at university. And Neil is a much better writer than I am. So I have to really struggle with it. But he edits it for me. And so he edits my writing. If I'm struggling with a painting, he'll come over and talk to me about it. So, you know, we've switched roles from parent to child, child to parent. And often, you know, he's teaching me.
Well, I think it's more like art groups, you know. We're sort of our own movement, in a way. Like, our artists are nothing without their network. When the art market crashed in the late 80s, 90s in New York City, and all these galleries closed and the artists were thrown out on the street, there was no internet right then, and there was very little networking online. It was still physical. There was still a lot of typing and things like that, and letters. And so artists were lost. We lost a lot of artists. And that's a clear evidence of how important the artist network is. So artists always band together. They group
together.
Like dogs.
Together. We're like dogs.
Although we're not really a movement and we don't have a manifesto, it's the same kind of thing. Like you need somebody to critique your work. You need somebody to talk to about these things. You know, marrying into a family of artists is not really the best thing for an artist. You know, what's really good for an artist is to marry somebody that's a little drier, but steady Eddie with the job, because that way you can focus on what you need to do, and that they can do some management skills that you don't really have or that you don't have time for.
Well, it's like Paul Klee said that every artist needs a wife. So my husband is my wife in that sense, because he supports me, you know, and he nurtures me. He's very careful not to be critical of whatever I'm doing, but to be supportive of it. And he kind of keeps me on track. And Neil's wife does the same thing. She's a school teacher. She does the same thing for him.
How does landscape impact your work?
We lived in Texas for a while. We lived in Seattle for a while. And, you know, and I was born in Montana. So I visited Montana more than any other state throughout my life. And, you know, I call Montana home. Boston, yeah, we lived there for a while, too. But the Western landscape, I was so homesick for the Western landscape, so homesick for the Rocky Mountains. It's like they're ballast at my back. And my favorite books to read are Montana writers. So Richard Ford, Tom McGuane, you know, Onyx Smith.
Jim
you know,
Welch.
The River Runs Through It, Jim Welch, of course. And I've read those books over and over, and they're about landscape. When I read that, or like yesterday and the day before, we just got in the car, we took our friends with us, and we drove to the Medicine Wheel. We drove to the mountain, and then we hiked to get to the Medicine Wheel. Surprisingly, we were the only people there on the solstice, which was just magical. Mm-hmm. We were able to pray and leave tobacco. Neil painted our faces, and it was really a really riveting, moving experience to be there. Neil and I spent years going to the Blackfeet Okons because the medicine ceremonies, because my cousin was married to a Blackfeet woman, and so that's where he received his Indian name. So the Montana landscape is really buried in my, and that's where, you know, I hope he scatters my ashes there. Mm-hmm. It's just in my whole being.
You know, you could look at art, almost any art, and you could dissect it or analyze it as landscape, because composition is landscape in many senses. So, like, even in some of your new paintings with the figures, the central figure, in a lot of ways, there's so much landscape in that.
Right.
And not just the key image in the background, but just the composition in general.
Yeah, there's a feeling that it came directly from Mother Earth with these rich palettes and the faces and body shapes. It does feel like it was lifted out of the earth.
Well, you know, when I was in school and studied art history, and they would talk about the wilderness and nothing being there. And of course, Timothy O'Sullivan, the photographer, was hired by the government to make sure that the West didn't appear to be inhabited so that they could sell the resources in the West, timber and mining and water and all that. I mean, that was when Lewis and Clark came, that was their motive, was to record the resources for Jefferson. They were interested, really, in plundering what was here. And of course, that's what happened. So, but, you know, as a Native person and growing up mostly outdoors, you know, I see the landscape as always inhabited, and I used to talk about that even when I was doing abstract work about, you know, the grass would ripple, but there are always insects and rabbits and things. And so when we're driving through the land, you know, we're always looking at a hawk, or he saw a fox yesterday. I mean, you know, we're always, it's that land is always constantly moving and there's always life there. And so to present the land as lifeless, even though it's desert, to me is always just a no-brainer, because if you live in the land, you know, it's always alive. So that's how I present my work. So if there's a figure in there, the figure is in the land, it's buried in the land. And I talk about that a lot in my lectures, too.
Speaking of imageries, is there a motif that you were particularly drawn to, iconography, or in terms of Native culture, are there certain motifs that you have used over and over again?
Oh, yeah, the pictographs and the petroglyphs. I mean, they're all over my reservation, and they're all over Montana. We went to the Painted Cave just so we, you know, they told us if we'd been there at a different time, we could see the black ones because the water comes out, seeps out from the back, and you can see them. It does something to the rock, and then they shine. We couldn't see those. We could only see the red ones. But, you know, I've got a whole collection of books on pictographs and petroglyphs from here. I'm always intrigued by that because, you know, I see that as early peoples. And, of course, Salish, we had to sign away all this land in the Hellgate Treaty. We were here. We've been here. You know, when friends tell me that from another tribe, they've been here for 20,000 years, they came in the Great Invasion. They were pushed in here. So all the other tribes were pushed here. We were here. This, you know, we're the ones who had to sign this land away. So that's always been, you know, and I think that's part of when you mentioned earlier about my drawerly line in the mud. I think it comes from that. I mean, I think it's just, it just seems innate.
A marking on the wall or marking in the mud, it has that same energy to it.
Oh, yeah.
He's marking on the wall. He painted everything. There was a French movie about a guy who went around and painted everything he saw. When he was little, you know, he would paint stuff in the house. It would appear.
It was the artist on Sesame Street.
Yeah, oh, the artist on Sesame Street.
Yeah, he had to put a number or the letter on everything he saw.
No, there was a French movie, too.
That's what that was based on.
Well, it was based on that. Yeah, and so I remember one Christmas we bought him a guitar, a beautiful white guitar, because he's a musician, and he writes his own music. And so his dad and I were just, we were so thrilled about that. And then he saw a little crack in it, and so his dad had to take it back to the store, get it perfect. And he probably didn't have it a week before he painted it. With all these different colors, and I thought his dad was just going to faint when he saw it. He was so, like, he thought this pristine white guitar would be so precious, and it was, but you know, he made it his own that way.
Well, you're both such complex, versatile artists. You paint, printmaking, sculpture, public art. You know, and Neil, you're doing 3D works. You use found objects, mixed media, and technology. I'm curious how you decide what direction you're going on a piece. Is it the canvas that dictates it? Is it the artist's brain, and then you find the medium to work with?
The medium or the message, right?
Right.
Well, I wrote a lot of that stuff down in my app that's available. It's free for...
We will actually note that. Anna was so excited about
I nerded out
app,
on that
so.
App this morning.
But a lot of that shared information that I grew up with that was disseminated. And then it's rooted in art history. Yeah. Yeah, that's what I said. That's, you know, I got it from you. I have like ADHD TV or whatever. And so I can get bored with something. And so I need to switch gears. And so what I learned early on is instead of getting artist block, writer's block, I'll do something else. So if something's not working out with a painting, I'll draw. If something's not working out with a drawing, I'll print. If something's not working with the print, I'll sculpt or whatever. I keep moving around, and so I'll have many projects simultaneously going at once. And but I'm always working.
Jean, your work is also multi-layered.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any painting that I can think of that doesn't have several layers of meaning and imagery. Maybe
certainly.
It's all paint, but it's certainly similar.
Well, in a way, like a writer who's composing a story, they're a narrative for sure. Early on, I was interested in teaching myself to paint, and then later I was more interested in the narrative after I learned to paint and telling stories, because I am political. But as I travel, I see things and I meet up with other Indian people, and you know, and all those stories fill my head. So they're layered, like a good story should be. They're visual. Sometimes I use text, sometimes not. And it's to tell something about the human condition from a native point of view.
With a blank canvas, you have to initiate the conversation as the artist. You have to begin. And so fortunately, we're mark makers, so it makes it easier for us, because we just go like this, ooh, that's going to be a good one. The more information that you introduce to the paper or the canvas or something, the more the conversation becomes involved, and then eventually you start listening to the work because it starts telling you.
In the native world, the process is the most important thing. Not the product, not the end product.
The process.
Not the idea that you think you have in your head, because it's not going to be there at the end. But it's the process. That is the whole thing. It's the thing that keeps us balanced. It's the thing that keeps us moving forward. And we don't know where that's exactly going to end. That's not what we were taught in school. What we're taught at university is to have a sketch and to work toward that and to make that happen. And that's your job. And in the Indian world, it's just the opposite. That is really the Indian way. That's right. What you make that for. It's the celebration of life. It's not for that market out there. It's not for self-aggrandizement. It's for the celebration of life and that feeling that you get from that.
Well, I want to thank you both for being here. This has been a delightful conversation.
Absolutely.
And thank inspirational.
You so thank you so much for having
thank
us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Neil Ambrose Smith's exhibit, Footprints on the Moon, is on display at the Northcutt Steel Gallery on the campus of MSU Billings until November 30th.
Footprints on the Moon is a series of large-scale, mixed-media prints exploring the connections between ancient storytelling and popular culture, individual memory, and collective memory.
Ambrose Smith's Cosmic Vision offers a cross-cultural invitation to consider the dimensions of tradition and identity that define and unite us in our contemporary global visual culture.
His exhibition is supported in part by the NEA and the Big Read, the National Endowment for the Arts, Artworks, and Arts Midwest.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains, produced by Anna Page, Corby Skinner, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Naumann. Hear this program anytime online at ypradio.org.